Good morning and thank you. I want to start by acknowledging my co-author on this paper, Namsa Malela. The title of our presentation, as was mentioned, is a qualitative assessment of young women's experience with the female condom in Durban. I don't know how much you know about South Africa, but South Africa has very high prevalence of HIV, and it continues to have the largest number of people living with AIDS in the world. In 2012, South Africa had a national HIV prevalence of 12%, indicating an increase from the estimated prevalence of 10.6% in 2008. There are also significant gender differences in the level of infection between males and females, with women more likely to be infected compared with their male counterparts. Most distressing is the high incidence of HIV infection among young women in particular. More than half of all infected adults acquired the virus before the age of 25. High levels of unwanted pregnancy also remain a huge public health concern among young women in South Africa. The number of unwanted pregnancies in women between the ages of 15 and 24 remains particularly high. At the national level, more than one-third of women have had their first child before the age of 20. Given the high levels of HIV and unwanted pregnancies among young women in South Africa, it obviously underscores the need for effective options to protect women's health. And these options include interventions such as the female condom that aim to empower women in sexual relations to initiate safer sex with their male partners. The female condom was first introduced to the South African community in 1998, and it is still the only female-initiated tool available that provides strong dual protection benefit for women. Since its first introduction, knowledge about and support and demand for female condoms have increased dramatically in South Africa. Today, the majority of primary health care facilities, together with hundreds of non-governmental organizations and other informal distribution sites, receive female condom supplies for distribution. In South Africa, the distribution of the female condom formed part of the national strategic plan of the South African Health Ministry's efforts to combat the scourge of HIV. A recent national survey suggested that almost 30% of women report ever using female condoms. So given this, our aim of the study was to explore female condom use among female university students in order to provide insights into the factors facilitating and inhibiting the use of the female condom. The study was conducted with 15 female university students who were ever users of the female condom, and ever users of the female condom included current and also former users. Current users were defined as those who reported using the female condom and had used it at least in their last sexual encounter. Former users were defined as those who reported using the female condom but were no longer using it at the time of the study. It should be noted, however, that some current users were not using the female condom consistently in all sexual encounters. How did we recruit the female condom users? Well, contact was made with the local campus clinic to help identify and to recruit potential participants, because the clinic holds the records of all students requesting the female condom. The campus clinic nurse contacted students whom they knew used the female condom and informed them about the study. Interested female condom users were then contacted by the researcher to arrange an interview. Almost all the participants indicated that they perceived themselves as being at high risk of contracting a sexually transmitted infection or having an unwanted pregnancy. They felt they were more at risk because of their lack of power in sexual relationships and protection from STIs, including HIV, and prevention of unwanted pregnancies were the initial reasons given by the majority of the participants for using the female condoms. And this is seen in some of the quotes that I'm going to show you when I'm discussing the results. The main reason for using the female condom is for protection, obviously, so that I would not have an unwanted pregnancy and I would not get an STI, said one woman. Other women also saw it as a way of empowering themselves. A female controlled method increased their power over their sexual health. One woman said, "It's empowering to know that as a woman, I get to decide to use the condom, as normally it is men who use the condom. For me personally, I also believe the female condom gives power to young women like me regarding my sexual health. It gives control over my body and a sense of control over my sexual life." Interestingly as well, some of the women also stated that they used the female condom out of curiosity for sexual experimentation. "To be honest," said one woman, "the main reason why I used the female condom was for sexual experimenting, to see what this thing is about. Because when we think about condoms, we only think about the male condom. It's difficult to imagine how the condom could work when you actually need to use it." More than half of the participants who were current users liked the female condom and preferred it to hormonal contraceptives. They repeatedly cited that the female condom provided dual protection for women against infections and unwanted pregnancy. They also articulated that hormonal contraceptives had side effects and that they were not used, for prevention of sexually transmitted infections. So it was interesting that they knew that hormonal contraceptive methods provided little or no protection, actually no protection against HIV. Unfortunately, there were some barriers, and perhaps that would explain why many of the women were former users of the female condoms. Inadequate availability is one of the most significant barriers to the consistent use of female condoms. The majority of the participants reported that the female condoms were not easily accessible. They were very rare and hard to obtain compared with male condoms, which were readily available in public places such as public toilets and also in the clinics. One woman stated, "I do not think the supply of the female condom is much these days like the male condom. In the clinic, as in the university clinic, for instance, I assure you that you will find not one or two male condoms, you will find boxes of male condoms. But rarely will you find a female condom. If you do, maybe you will find one or two on display just so that women will know that it exists. You cannot even find female condoms in the toilet. Even here in the university, you can only find the male condom, but not the female condom." Many of the participants felt that there was a lack of awareness about the female condom. They reported that in most cases, the majority were not well informed about its availability. They also highlighted that it was hardly advertised compared with the male condom, and they felt that there was not sufficient promotion of the female condom in the media. "I feel like there's not enough awareness, because many women are not well informed about the female condom. If you go to the nearest toilet, you will find adverts or pamphlets on the male condom, and you will find the male condom in the toilet. But with regard to the female condom, you will hardly find it in public toilets, and you hardly come across pamphlets advertising it. I also do not think there is much communication about the female condom from the media to the people." Many participants also reported difficulties in inserting and properly positioning the female condom when they started using it, even though it came with instructions. "The major problem was actually at the beginning when I first started to use the female condom. I experienced difficulties when I tried to insert it. I read the instructions, but it was not easy. The practical part of actually applying it was a nightmare. I was not really sure how much you need at the bottom and how far to push it up. I had to do it over and over again." The majority of the participants reported that although they wanted to protect themselves, they required the cooperation of their male partners to use the female condom. They further highlighted men's reluctance to use it, highlighting that men believed that the female condom interfered with sexual pleasure, and for that reason, they did not approve of its use. They reported also using certain strategies to negotiate female condom use with their partners, such as suggesting the use of the female condom for pregnancy prevention or telling them about the side effects they had experienced with hormonal contraceptives. Although I want to protect myself, I cannot use the female condom without my partner. He needs to agree. Most men do not like using condoms, and they will never approve of its use. They believe that it interferes with sexual pleasure. It's easy to use the female condom with my partner if I discuss it for pregnancy prevention. The female condom is one of the government's strategies to fight the HIV pandemic in South Africa. The study findings suggest that female university students are using female condoms for protection against the dual risk of infections and pregnancy. However, there's an urgent need for the government to increase the availability of female condoms and make them widely accessible to the entire population. Providing adequate information and increasing male involvement in female condom use is essential to women's empowerment. Male involvement in female condom use is important in facilitating consistent use of the device and in empowering women. Obviously, more research is needed on female condom use, especially among larger groups of female condom users and their male partners, in order to get a holistic picture of factors facilitating and also inhibiting use, and also to identify strategies to increase its consistent use. There's also a need for more research on never uses of the female condom to understand barriers to use. Thank you very much.
We want to thank all our presenters for their rich presentations. I want to thank my co-moderator, Vivian, for keeping us on time. Would all the panelists please come up? I'm sure there are going to be questions. Thank you. Okay, we're open for questions or comments. You can direct it to individuals or the entire panel. Yes, please.
Thank you so much, all of you, for sharing your research and your stories about a very important topic. And this question is specifically for Julie, in thinking about the reporting aspect for women that have experienced sexual violence. It sounds like in many of the settings where you interview people, women, it's always the he said, she said, and so for women to have to go report, I'm assuming a lot of the police force in many countries are male-dominated. Please correct me if my assumption is wrong, but if it's not, was there any discussion of moving to include female police officers that may create a more safe zone for women to feel like they can go report sexual violence in a more timely manner?
The police forces are still male-dominated in each of these countries, but actually in all four locations there had been the creation of, sometimes they're called gender desks, but police, specialized police units that are staffed by a female officer and are supposed to provide more privacy and a separate space for survivors to report. So in Sierra Leone, they're called family support units. There's a child and family protection unit, CFPU, in Uganda, so they have different terms. I think the challenge that we saw across these settings was that often they're there in name, but then if you go there, there actually isn't a private space, or there's just one female officer who's supposed to be staffed there, and if she's not there, police officers are telling survivors they can't report, come back later. So it almost, in some ways, led to kind of an abdicating responsibility of the issue of sexual violence to just the specialized officers or the specialized unit. And so one thing we recommend in our report is further evaluation of these units, because they've really been proliferating in a lot of countries, but there hasn't really been much research or evaluation at all. But there are, and there also are some efforts to try to recruit more female police officers, particularly in Liberia.
Thank you. I'm Edward, who will come to talk to them, and I'm currently at the University of Boston, Boston School of Public Health. I am quite interested in your talk about the sexual violence that we see. Coming from South Sudan, we were conflict, then we were post-conflict, and then we were back to conflict. So it's the whole issue. And if you read some of the reports that have come out from AU, it has talked a lot about sexual violence and rape and all these things. But despite all of that, our main problem is probably institutional, because the system doesn't support any of these things. Mm-hmm. And you have not addressed it as one of the recommendations. Secondly, I lived in Zimbabwe all my life, and it has become worse with the conflict. Rapes are there. I've been in the hospitals. Reports come, people come in, they fill the forms and all that. But I've never heard of anybody being prosecuted or prosecuted, I mean, because of sexual violence. It has never happened, although the reports have been done. What can be done, especially to prove that this person did it? I know in the US there are kids that you collect from pockets, etc., but in South Sudan, against you, you will not have a proof that this is the guy who did it. What is that you are recommending for coming to
the
and we need
the
training
after
that?
A couple of things. In our study, actually the larger study, so today I just talked about some of the challenges currently, but the study looks at conflict and post-conflict settings, and we tried to gather lessons learned from practitioners about what the main barriers were during conflict. And that what you're mentioning in South Sudan, there was reporting, but there was very little evidence collection by healthcare providers during conflict, and then also almost no prosecution during the conflict periods in Uganda and Sierra Leone and Liberia, and during the post-election violence period in Kenya was very brief. But so I would say that I think there's been an effort now to, I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, the UK summit that happened last year with Foreign Secretary William Hague and Angelina Jolie pulling together this summit on ending sexual violence in conflict. But they launched an international protocol on the documentation and investigation of sexual violence in conflict settings. And it's really trying to focus on what can be collected right now at the time to pave the way for prosecution later. So we've seen one study that Physicians for Human Rights did was using medical records of sexual assault cases to show patterns of violence affecting an entire community later. And that evidence can be used to support sexual violence as an international crime, like as a crime against humanity. I think one thing that needs more discussion is the role of healthcare providers in conflict settings, because increasingly there's all this pressure for them to collect more evidence, but there's practical and I think ethical challenges with that. And practically there's, how much can we actually expect them to document and collect in an emergency setting when they're just constantly in triage and trying to provide these services, and what can you store in that setting? And then also ethically, I think, sometimes the only protection healthcare providers have is their perceived neutrality in a conflict setting. And so then once you're sort of elevating their role in evidence collection for things like international crimes, that kind of implications on their safety or on survivors seeking their care. So there are a lot of conflict-specific considerations. I don't want to talk too long, but I can share a copy of our report with you. And we do some trainings, and we have lawyers on staff that do training on this issue. So. A little too long there, sorry.
My question is for the first one, the last, right?
Yes.
So I was
I'm wondering about, is that a consideration?
So we did ask about ethnic group, or we asked about nationality. We didn't ask about ethnic group. So and our sample was about half Somali, maybe a little more than a third from South Sudan, and the rest were mostly from DRC, Rwanda, or Burundi. Mostly of those were from the DRC. We had kind of a small sample, so it wasn't really possible to see, we didn't do a lot of significance tests, mostly. We did on that, just comparing the two groups to each other, but not on the other indicators, because we didn't want to assume that would tell us too much. We still thought that the groups aren't necessarily comparable. So in the questionnaire, we have that information. I know we did some analysis of it. I can't remember if there were meaningful differences. Mm-hmm. I think there were not enough women from the Great Lakes, and then we had four from Uganda and Ethiopia. Mm-hmm. So I can't really remember. I don't have it with me. I was going to say I have the report here, but that's not in the report. We also did focus groups, and the focus groups were, we had some with girls, girls with children, girls without children, parents, and boys. And what we found from the focus groups was that the Congolese were much more, they wanted more information. The parents wanted more information. They were more open to the adolescents having sex. And in the Somali community, it tended to be that if a girl got pregnant, she got married. And whereas in the South Sudan had the Sudanese and everyone except the Somalis, pretty much, it wasn't automatic that you would get married if you got pregnant. But girls did tend to drop out of school. But so sorry, I can't answer your question, but I could email you if you, yeah. So what we had questions about where they got information, and most of them said they got information from school. That was the main thing, was from school, and then some from parents or friends. What we think with the myths, so there were two big myths. One was that family planning causes infertility, particularly the pill. And then the other one was that condoms are really dangerous because if you don't use them correctly, they'll get lost in your body. And what we think of the condom issue is that there's been this emphasis on using correct use of condoms, and it's gotten to the point that these kids are afraid. I mean, they would talk about it, most adolescents can't use a condom correctly. And so I think that correct use has been overemphasized. The other thing is that they weren't getting information that family planning is reversible. So it's been used for limiting family size. And I think a lot of them didn't even know that family planning was a general term. They thought family planning was a method, and pill was a different method, and a condom was a different method. And that once you were done having kids, then you used family planning. But yeah, so it was basically they were hearing stuff in the background, and there was just a lot of rumors, I think. And then this really strong emphasis by everyone on just remain abstinent.
I have a question for but I guess anyone, if you have anything to add, would be awesome. But you brought up the topic of when it's appropriate for the interviewer or the researcher to be an interview someone who is from a similar background or an outsider. I'm questioned that a lot as well, and so I didn't know if you had any experiences where you did see that it maybe was better if someone was from a similar background, or it created, you gathered more accurate research, or if it was just as culturally sensitive from outside.
So we had kind of a unique situation in that we had like so many different nationalities, and they're all really in close proximity. So what I'm going to say, it's just anecdotal. It's not like systematic. So Somali girls always wanted to be, if there was a Somali, we had both times we had one Somali interviewer and a lot more from just a lot more Congolese and Sudanese. But if Somali girls saw a Somali, they all wanted to be interviewed by her. But then because they knew she was Somali, it was two different women before and after, they both said that then the Somali girls would not admit to having sex. That was a big thing, that we think there are way higher rates of having sex than they would admit. That picture, the reason I had the picture of the girl with the little boy is because she was, I think she was Congolese, but she could, like anyone, she could get anyone to talk about anything with her. And she had been trained as a one of these gender-based violence caseworkers who would bring people to the clinic and stuff. And so I think a lot of it was that she just had like really great empathy and interpersonal skills. But I do think it helped that there's this idea that Congolese think it's okay to have sex. And so I can tell this Congolese woman that I'm having sex, whereas if I tell a Somali, so for us what it came down to was just language skills a lot of times, and then who is physically there. So that's my impression, but I would love to hear from other people what they think about that.
I had a lot of interesting feedback from our study team in Ghana. We went through extensive training with our whole team of research assistants in both cities and tried to standardize it as much as possible. But there were gender differences. We had at least two male interviewers. One of them was very, I would say, comfortable with the ladies, and women wanted to be interviewed by him. He's an attractive young guy, very smart, he was a college student. So there was a little bit of power dynamic happening there, but they all felt comfortable talking to him. And we discussed amongst the team members what additional training above the standardized training might be appropriate in that specific context, given I don't know how like it was on the verge of potentially being too easy of a relationship with the interviewee. And on the flip side, we had young women who were interviewers, and some of them were enrolled in university programs, and there was a perception of maybe judgment or reluctance to share with those women, and they were in-country residents, many from the same background as our participants were. So we were trying to consider gender and age and all of these sort of power dynamics, and we learned a lot, but I don't know that I had a right answer of ways. I mean, I think we had regular discussions with our research team, and I got regular reports from my program managers who were overseeing them. And so it was a fluid process. We were constantly giving tips and pointers. We had them all read some standardized sort of qualitative textbooks about how to engage in interviews, and I think that was overall helpful. But in terms of the cultural kinds of issues, there are a few parts.
I will make one more comment based on experience in other surveys, which I used to work on a mosquito net project, so it wasn't that sensitive. And if I was with interviewers, like supervising, everyone would accept to be interviewed. Like the interviewers always wanted me to come along because they're like, oh, then the people will talk to us because you're here. But even though I didn't understand, they were usually interviewing in a different language, so it was just as private.
Negotiation of the struggle with the male condom. So that gives you an idea of what's actually happening in the